Well, would you be good enough to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 to page 170 of the New Testament sections of the Church Bibles? And if you were here last Sunday night and you're thinking we're circling over familiar territory, let me assure you, you're quite right. And the reason I want to do it is because I feel at the moment I'm still seeing through a glass darkly. And yet that there are very important truths in these early verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Very important truths for our Christian ministry. Because they begin to look at what one might call the unacceptable face of Christian ministry. Paul is touching in this first paragraph, verses 1 to 6, on what at least seems like failure. He touches in the next paragraph, verses 7 to 12, on what at least seems like weakness. Now, if we've experienced failure or we know something of the weakness that he's writing about here, we're probably very grateful for this apostolic honesty. It seems refreshing compared with much we hear about today. But we have to know that failure and weakness are hardly box office successes in the 1980s any more than they were in the first century at Corinth. They raise all kinds of question marks. They did to the Corinthians. Paul is battling for his ministry in this letter. It's one of the most personal of all his letters. If you're the sort of person who, when you hear Paul, at times gets fed up and say, look, stop throwing his doctrine at me. Try and explain him to me. What makes him tick? Then do read this letter and find out. What makes him tick is his doctrines. And as he wrestles in this verse with these issues, he doesn't just give us answers, but reasons. He's not just saying, well, sorry, but that's just part of life, you'll have to grin and bear it. He doesn't just give us the command, do it. He starts to explain. And if we've had something explained, and if we've begun to understand it, we're much more likely to keep going, aren't we? And that's the thrust of this chapter. Not losing heart, not shirking our duty, not giving up, keeping going. So let's begin with failure. Paul facing failure. You noticed it, I imagine, in that first paragraph. It comes in very clearly in verse 3 as he talks about his gospel being veiled, that is to say, not being understood, veiled to those who are perishing. It comes out very clearly, as he explains, in verses 4 to 6. He's speaking for the moment of those who do not respond to his gospel. But do notice how he defends what he preaches. When you think about it, it's rather surprising. He doesn't say what he could have said, which is, well, just a moment, before you harp on those who don't respond, what about those who did? Look what I have accomplished. Mark Europe didn't produce the list of statistics with the churches he's founded, the numbers who've responded at his rallies, the converts who came forward. No, there's not a mention of them. He goes back to his understanding of what is going on, to the doctrines of verses 4 to 6. And because he does that, it can help us. Would have been totally useless, wouldn't it, if we got a list of the churches he'd founded? It would have been no encouragement whatsoever to you, I imagine, certainly none to me, to keep going. Now, because of what he states in verse 4, because of what's happened to him in verse 6, so he says what he does is verse 5, what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. It's the key verse. It tells us what to do, but it explains those verses around it. You see, verse 5 is saying more than just we preach Jesus, isn't it? Saying more than he just carries on preaching. It's a verse of contrasts. Not everyone is preaching the same thing. What we preach is not ourselves, he says. but Jesus Christ as Lord, ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. The implication is that some people are preaching themselves. It may be that Paul's been accused of it. It's certainly the inference through this letter that those causing trouble at Corinth are doing just that, preaching themselves. That word "for" at the beginning of the verse is not a weak word. It gives the link to what went before. Look, start again at verse 4. Let's have a look at this. In their case, the case of those who've not responded to Paul's gospel, the god of this world, Satan, has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who's the likeness of God. For what we preach is that Christ that the god of this world is blinding their minds so that they won't see. What we preach is exactly the message that runs into the kind of opposition of verse 4. Isn't that what he's saying? No wonder we have a hard time with our message. You see, we're preaching the very thing that the god of this world is all geared up to oppose. That's the problem he's having. It's a problem that others may not have. That's why Paul is under such pressure. You see, you have your gospel message and you meet resistance. Well, you don't automatically give up. You know you're not the only one meeting resistance. You say, okay, no one's doing well at the moment. People have rebellious, sinful natures. This is a hard area for the gospel. You not heard people say that? Everyone says it. I was at a church growth course in Norwich once, and the lecturer was asked this question, said, didn't he realize that the country was a hard area for the gospel? And he said, wherever he's been, people have assured him that their particular area was particularly hard for the gospel. The person at the back put his hand up and said, yes, but the difference about Norfolk is that here it's true. It's always a hard area for the gospel. But what happens when you meet resistance? You're having it hard, and someone else is thriving. Someone else actually seems to be making progress. Isn't the pressure on then? Isn't that when we tend to get frightened to change our message? We think we must have got it wrong. Why, they're gaining ground. I suspect something like that is happening to Paul. There is no doubt whether they were in practice or not. These other people around at Corinth were very good at talking themselves up. They appeared to be making progress. Why are you having such difficulties, Paul? Have you got the wrong message? Jesus Christ as Lord, rapidly fading, isn't it? You see it in the people's consciousness as a whole in this country. He's not Lord, he's one of the Lords. You see it in what we're meant to teach in the schools, in religious education. We're not allowed to teach him as the Lord. Why is that? Well, it can't be disassociated from the growing rise of Islam. Someone was, Claire was telling me that she'd been told there were 150 mosques in London. No, once we're threatened with something else, we begin to say, well, we better just change the message slightly. Now, how does Paul react? He's going to keep on explaining what is going on in the world. That's why he'll keep to his message. You see, the fact that there's the god of this world opposed to him, the fact that it takes the god of creation in verse 6 to actually penetrate someone's heart, doesn't lead him to say, so what we need to do is to pray, though that's true. It actually leads him to say, we'll keep preaching Jesus Christ as Lord. He is central to all these verses. Did you see that? It's Jesus, it's Christ, that the god of this world is trying to stop, verse 4. It's Jesus, it's the face of Christ, that it takes the god of creation to shine into our hearts, verse 6. We must see that this is what's going on in our ministry, or we'll never understand our failure. In their case, verse 4, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing Christ. Why? Because he is the likeness of God. What would happen if people actually saw Christ for who he was? Why? They'd recognize the God of this world for who he is, not God. So no wonder all his energies are bent on stopping people seeing who Christ is. Now that'll mean he'll promote evil, no doubt. He'll promote atheism, no doubt. But actually it'll mean he'll promote anything but Jesus Christ as Lord. That's why religion, as mere religion, is so popular. That's why he's no worries if people believe in ethics, third world, personal development, a Jesus who meets my needs. Anything, isn't it? But the Christ, who's Lord, who's the likeness of God, they can believe in all those other things and still have the God of this world. Why do some of these other groupings seem to proliferate and have success? Why do the JWs do well? Why do some of these false teachers seem to have success? Well, they only have to persuade people. If our ministry is to minister Jesus Christ as Lord, we have to bring sight to blinded people. We can't do it, of course. But when we look at verse 6, we discover that there is a message. A message that the God of creation backs. That the God who way back in Genesis 1 said, "Let light shine out of darkness," will actually command and will happen again. And the message is to be found in the face of Christ. See, what God says, he does, doesn't he? God said, "Let light shine," and there was light. That's what we heard in our reading. So verse 6 reads like this. It's the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness." It doesn't go on to say, "Who says," again. No, he takes the other half of it. Who does? Who has shone in our hearts. That's where he's shone, right in our hearts, in the center of our being. And he's given the light of the knowledge of the glory of God there. And where? How does he do it? In the face of Christ. I was coming out of Bank Tube on Thursday or Friday morning, and I looked up at the Life Building, that futures exchange. I forget what it used to be before it became that. And I noticed for the first time at the top of it, there's a little stone tablet in that rather fine front of the building, and it's got inscribed on it, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." It's very fine. I hadn't noticed it till then. I wondered how many people who stream in there to work every day have even seen it. Certainly wonder how anyone in there really believes it and has taken it to their hearts. And it's actually the center of their action and their minds and their wills and their decisions. It's one thing to write it up, isn't it? But minds are blinded. It'll only be carried right into that building when God shines Jesus into people's hearts. So if God, who alone can penetrate blindness, does it in the face of Christ, then, says Paul, he'll preach Jesus Christ as Lord. It's the one message that'll penetrate. What we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. Now, notice that. There's the temptation. It's always strengthened when you face failure. The temptation is to preach ourselves. I was struggling with that. I thought, how on earth do I actually convince anyone sitting in a pew at St. Helens that it's a real temptation that we'll preach ourselves? We all know we're meant to preach Jesus Christ as Lord. I was talking with Nigel beforehand. He said, well, it's obvious, isn't it? As soon as you do any form of service, you find that temptation. We all want to make a good impression. He's right, isn't he? This isn't an alarm bell for some obscure people back in Corinth in the first century. It must be an alarm bell for all of us today. Look at what we do in church. You see, here's the relationship he's struggling with. It's the messenger and the message, isn't it? What we preach is not ourselves. We are not the message. Jesus Christ is the message. Our position is your servants, your slaves. Well, how we dress people up in church? Just like slaves? Our church language. How can we reconcile this verse with enthroning bishops? Well, merely our approach to what we believe the message is, the kind of I think theology, the brain power of the radical theologian. Isn't that preaching himself? Well, watch our evangelism. We can't really grasp these verses and still have that scalp-hunting mentality. But haven't you felt it at times? The longing to be able to say, I brought him to the Lord. You don't believe verse 6. It's only God who can bring to the Lord. I met a group from Singapore this week who've come over to this country. They've been sent by their church to found a church in London. You won't meet them. They're fairly obscure. They're working in the streets and the parks and so on. They've been over here for about 2 or 3 months. They have a meeting with them, some 30 others now. I was very struck. I'm sure there would be issues on which we'd probably disagree, but we didn't in what we talked about, because they told me what they said to those they met, and they were preaching Jesus Christ as Lord. I said, do you find everyone welcomes you? And they said, no. Plenty of people rebuff them. What do? Go to the next one and preach Jesus Christ as Lord. I was waiting for the appeal. I thought there must be something they wanted from us. Was it going to be the money appeal at the end? No. No, their church has funded them. 28 of them fly over to Singapore, stay here for 6 months. They do it in a number of places around the world. The mission budget is greater than the general budget in their church. They seem to me to have got this balance right of verse 5. They weren't preaching themselves. They were preaching Jesus Christ with themselves as servants. One of them was out in the park the other day and they came across someone lying in the bushes, glue sniffing. What did they do? Look the other way? No. Patched them up as best they could, got them to hospital, came back to explain what they could of Jesus. Paul, faced with failure, keeping to his task, not losing heart, not giving up. Yes, it's there. Of course it's there. The very essence of our message guarantees it'll be there. The God of this world has blinded the minds to keep them from seeing Christ. Well, secondly and more briefly, but just as importantly, verse 7, Paul wrestling with weakness. We have this treasure in earthen vessels, he says, to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us. Here's another sniper fire he's taking on. The image, the impression he has. The impression he gives, rather. See, this is what's going to question his ministry. I see in the papers this week that the Conservative Party is struggling to work out which advertising agency it should pay attention to, whether it's Saatchi and Saatchi or the other one. I don't know what image they'll come up with for the next election. I just guarantee that whatever it is, this will not be the one that Mrs. Thatcher or any other politician, for that matter, will take on board. The picture of the earthen vessel, useful but frail. Not quite the scene for a Prime Minister, is it? And yet that's what Paul claims for himself. We've got to face this issue because, you see, it runs against the grain of the culture we're living in. It runs against the grain of every culture. It's a picture of weakness for the messenger. It's the picture of that glittering diamond you've always longed your husband, boyfriend, whatever, to buy you, rolling up in a cardboard box. Makes you question, doesn't it? You wonder whether actually he got it from Woolies instead of Mappin and Webb. Because it should have come in one of those little velvet concoctions, you know, that doubles the price. Isn't that what's happening here? Paul, you're not up to much. Are we really meant to believe you've got the proper message? If you really have it, if it really is so glorious, if it really is so powerful, if it really is so accurate about God, why are you so weak? Now, what Paul writes of himself has been true of Christian ministers, even the great ones, down the centuries, hasn't it? Depression? Now, from Spurgeon to David Watson. They've known that. Shyness, awkwardness, have you never known people like that? Nervous? Anxious, tired, with hardly the kind of voice or appearance that could possibly bring saving good news from God. It's bodily weakness he's speaking of. It's anathema, isn't it, to a success society? As you read through this paragraph, verses 8 and 9 in particular, afflicted, perplexed, persecuted, struck down, Paul is not Clint Eastwood. Hard for the Corinthians to accept then that he's actually God's true messenger. Come forward a few pages and just see some of the things they're saying about him and he's having to face. Chapter 10, page 174. Chapter 10, verse 10. You see, his bodily presence is weak. Didn't look much. Probably pretty scarred. Across the page, chapter 11, verse 6. In a mood when he's not willing to give much ground, even he admits he might be unskilled in speaking. He didn't sound up to much. He's up against the people in verse 5, these superlative apostles. Strong, fluent, persuasive, much to boast of. As we drove in today, I saw that Brill Cream is back on the market. There was a great big advertising hoarding up. And their slogan is, first impressions count. And you're meant to be smart or something. I should have thought it's just sort of greasy. But there we are. Now, as we come back to our passage in 2 Corinthians 4, Paul isn't suggesting that first impressions don't count. He's not setting out to be deliberately scruffy or anything like that. He's just saying, be careful of the conclusions you're drawing. You see him as weak, under pressure, harried. Don't write him off. Isn't it encouraging as you look at these verses to know that the apostle was weak too? If you feel like that. But verse 7 is written not just so that we can empathize with him. It says something more than that. It says that this weakness is quite deliberate. We have this treasure in earthen vessels to show that. Do you see, it's not that Paul is all these rather weak things, and at the end of the day at least we can say, oh well, some good has come out of it. We can see it must be God's power. Now, says Paul, there is a deliberate planning about our weakness. Why, God is so arranging the circumstances that we cannot be glorified. We're far too earthen a vessel for that. And how grateful we should be if that's true. We're sunk if we are glorified. Do you get the point? It actually changes our attitude to all our weaknesses if we begin to grasp this. Are you at the point where you can acknowledge weakness? Some of us have no choice. Others of us just cover up well. Are you encouraged as you read of the apostle to admit weakness? Well, you won't have understood this paragraph until, like Paul, you're actually able to boast of weakness. That's hard, isn't it, today? What would Rambo make of that? Boasting of weakness. But this verse 7 is simply verse 5 applied, isn't it? In one particular area. 2 Corinthians exposes us more to Paul the man than any other letter, which is very odd in the light of verse 5 when he says, what we preach is not ourselves. But what do we learn of him? Why, we learn of his weaknesses. That's what he keeps on telling us about. You know those biographies which tell you all about how wonderful the guy is, and these days they know they're not allowed to do that all the time, so there's a little chapter telling you of some of his faults, but how they didn't really matter too much. And then you get hold of his diaries and you discover something completely different. Well, it's like that here. We'd never establish all the sufferings we read of in 2 Corinthians from reading Acts. They're not all there. Starts the whole letter by telling of his sufferings in chapter 1. He repeats again, sufferings in chapter 4. These aren't just physical defects we're looking at, are they? He's afflicted, he's perplexed, he's persecuted. Isn't that strange? He claims he's got God's message. So what's God going to do with his messenger? Drive him out of everywhere he goes? How can we believe that? He's struck down. Across the page, chapter 6, verse 4. As servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way. Just read the next two verses. Later on in the letter, he's going to say of these other people, are they servants of Christ? Well, I'm a better one, he says. And lists the number of times he's been imprisoned, beaten, lashed, shipwrecked. Says in the end, I'll all the more gladly boast of my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, calamities. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. Now, he's not a masochist. No, look at what he's saying closely as we finish. Verse 7, he's saying, it's abundantly clear, isn't it? The more earthen vessel I appear, the weaker I appear, the clearer it is that the power is God's. Why is he preaching Jesus Christ all the time? Because only Jesus Christ can penetrate. So is he ashamed to be weak? No. Because the power wasn't him in the first place. It wasn't his persuasive power. I do hope we understand that. I must admit I find it a difficult lesson to learn. Someone challenges me about a weakness I want to cover up. Why? I want to look powerful. I read this from Willie Still, the minister in Aberdeen. I want to convince you, he said at a conference for ministers, that this life down here at its very best is the veil of cross-bearing. I was telling our people on Sunday evening when I came to Aberdeen over 33 years ago, I determined on two things which I have since proved to the hilt to be utterly incompatible. I determined to be a successful minister, as the world or the worldly church sees it. And I determined also to be faithful to Jesus Christ. But it had to be one or the other. For it's impossible to be faithful to Jesus Christ and not incur the opposition of the world, the flesh, and the devil. It will cost, within and without. And the most dangerous point of all is when, after paying a certain price for following Jesus, you think you've graduated, and all will be sweetness and light, without another trouble. Now, Paul was happy to be weak. He'd put away the Brill Cream so that everyone could see the power was not his, but God's. He was happy to be weak because it was the mark of the servant. He was following the path of Jesus. He was suffering the path of the cross. That's what he's going to say at the end of that paragraph. He's actually experiencing the life of Jesus, because although he is afflicted, he's not crushed. Although he is perplexed and ought to have given up, he's not driven to despair. Although he is persecuted, actually every time he's driven out, he's not abandoned. He gets an opportunity in another city. Although he is struck down, he's not destroyed. And he's showing not only the life of Jesus in himself, but the ministry of Jesus. For Jesus to bring life to people, he had to die. Well, Paul was suffering the death of Jesus, so to speak. And the result, verse 12, death at work in us, life in you. True Christian ministry will be like Christ's, and it'll look weak. There's the sting in the tail, isn't it? For all the apparent failure, for all the apparent weakness, this is not a fruitless ministry. He's writing to the Corinthians. He's always able to say, oh, of course, as a result of my ministry, there is you. He won them in the first place. And let's get the point that we're all meant to get nowhere as a result of these verses. There's an irony in the talk of failure, isn't there? Actually, a gospel ministry brings glory and people to glory. There's an irony in the talk of weakness. It really shows where the true power is. Let's pray. Sovereign Lord, deliver us, we pray, from this longing to make an impression, from the pressures of others on us to look good and appear powerful. Keep our hearts and our minds and our lips centered on Jesus Christ as Lord. And may the transcendent power be obviously yours, for Jesus' sake. Amen.